Marty Moscow-Wayne, welcome back to Radio Times. Just the way the greatest generation complained about the me generation in the 1960s, millennials get a bad rap these days. You know, they're lazy, they're entitled, self-centered, and would rather text on their cell phone than have a face-to-face conversation with an actual person. While young adults face some tough challenges when it comes to unemployment and debt and our dysfunctional political system, many of them are civically engaged, optimistic about the future, and are transforming their communities where they live. So today in Radio Times, how millennials see the world. We're talking about people born between 1980 and 1994, and we have three of them joining us on Radio Times. David Burstein is the CEO of Run for America, and he's also the author of a book called Fast Future, How Millennials Are Shaping Our World. And he joins us from the New York Bureau. And David Burstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. It's been about 6 years.
Great to be with you.
And also with us and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Juliana Reyes. She began, is actually lead reporter at Technically Philly, and that is a job that she started in July 2012. Juliana Reyes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And also with us is Emily Doley, and she's a producer of the Ideas Conference, TEDx Philadelphia, organizer of the West Rockland Street Project in Germantown. And Emily, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
So let's get rid of, or let's deal with what baby boomers say about millennials. And I have to say, I am a baby boomer, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to do the show is because I hear my generation complaining about your generation. And David, if I can just get a response, something you write about in your book about, I guess, why the young generation, always called the me generation, then gets criticized by their elders.
Well, I think one of the things that is true about this generation is it's a different generation from the generations that have come before, and we're living through an unprecedented period of change where the technologies, the ways we communicate, the ways we enter relationships, the ways we exercise our work, all of these things have undergone a transformative change. So for people of older generations, they look at some of these trends and they are either disarming that they're changing, or they look at them, they just simply don't understand. The idea that people, for instance, half of the people who are in this generation someday say they'd like to start their own business,
right,
you know, can sometimes lead to a sense of employees sitting in a company and people feeling like they're entitled, they're not grateful for the job to be there. So I think there's really a generational misunderstanding, which often leads to sort of this critical reputation that baby boomers and people of other generations put onto this generation.
What are your thoughts, Emily?
I would have to agree with what David is saying there. I think that we just have a tendency to view any generation that we're not a part of with skepticism and criticism, whether we're looking up or down.
Does that mean you're sometimes looking down at the upcoming generation?
Oh, completely, completely. Like, I have some younger cousins that are about 12 and 13, and just the way that they use Facebook versus the way that I use Facebook is just incredibly different to me, versus the way that my parents are using Facebook as a communications tool as well, and what people are willing to post about themselves and have conversations about publicly. So I just think that it's natural.
And that feels natural. How about for you, Julia?
Yeah, I would agree with what Emily and David said. And I guess there's also that tendency to generalize about like a group of people that maybe you just don't understand. So it's confusing, and it's easier to sort of group them into, this one like subset, like what? Millennials.
Well, and it's, you know, sort of terrible to do a show about millennials and having three of, you know, what is it, 80 million millennials, David, that are growing up and becoming adults in the United States?
Yes, it's true. It's the largest generation in history, and globally, it's over a billion people in this generation. And so I think that's one of the reasons why really understanding this generation is very important, because when we talk about this generation, because of the times that this generation is living in, this isn't just about young people. It's about the future. It's about what the next 20 to 30 years of life on our planet are going to look like and how institutions are going to be transformed, which is why I think, you know, it's so important to really to get this right, because we always have, you know, the next new generation. What are young people thinking? What are young people doing? But in this generation, we're actually creating the technologies, the platforms, the new traditions and habits that are going to be mainstream for the next several decades.
I am a baby boomer. And so for my generation, we were shaped by things like the sexual revolution, the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the assassination of Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And I wonder for you, Emily, as you sort of look back on your life, what have been some seminal moments in your experience of the world?
I think when I was in college was during September 11th, and I think that that was, I was a freshman at George Washington University in D.C., which is, it was quite an experience to also be in the nation's capital during that period and living so close to so many government institutions. And I think that that was, that's probably the biggest shift in terms of how I felt as an American living in this country.
Did you feel unsafe?
I did. Yeah, definitely. But at the same time, watching how the nation reacted to creating, to making us feel safer, so with regards to security and control and privacy and whatnot afterwards, we're still seeing a huge reaction to that now, was probably the biggest thing for me.
Were the attacks on 9/11? How about for you, Juliana? As you think back over some growing up.
Yeah, I say maybe just because of my job, but I definitely think back about all sort of how the technology has changed over the years. And I think that definitely there's sort of like these marking points. So there was like in middle school when you were on AIM, so AOL Instant Messenger, and that was how you talked to everyone. And then like growing up, like downloading music off of things like Kazaa and like Napster, and then when Facebook started. So I feel like all of those are sort of like marking points, and especially having to do with like social interactions.
Using the sort of social media to interact with people. I'm just curious, when you were a little kid, like a toddler, did you have a computer in your house?
No. My dad was, he worked in technology, so we might have had a computer that he like did work on, but we didn't use them. Yeah.
Yeah. How about for you, David? What do you see as sort of seminal moments in your formative years?
Well, I think both what was mentioned are certainly part of that. There are two things that I would add on to that. One of my earliest memories is Columbine, when I was in middle school or late elementary school. And for me, and when I did the book, I talked to a lot of people about that incident and really found that it was an incident that could have made people feel very afraid, but what studies have shown is that it actually made this generation feel more that they had to look out for other people and they had to, protect each other and they had to band together. I think that was really seminal. The other thing I remember very well and has, I think, had a huge impact on this generation was coming of age during the Monica Lewinsky scandal the Clinton years. And, really, I think that was the beginning of coloring this generation's perception of politics, because you start with, seeing our president as a flawed person, deeply flawed person, in this sort of very polarized environment, and then you continue that through the Bush administration and what's happened after that and two wars. That was really the beginning of how this generation views politics, which is not in the best light. We've never seen our political system operating at its best. We've never seen our politicians really as role models for the most part that we could look up to. So I think those experiences really have shaped this generation a lot.
And I know I want to get back to that, but just a quick, your CEO, David, of Run for America, a postpartisan initiative to recruit, train, and elect a new wave of political leaders. So while you might feel suspicious of our political system, you also want people to run.
Yeah, and I think it's indicative of a larger trend, which is that there's not apathy for the system. There's just frustration and cynicism and a desire and a hope for it to be better.
Emily, you nodded when he said the Monica Lewinsky scandal of the Clinton years.
Yeah, but more so what I'd like to piggyback off of is that latter comment about the apathy and frustration with the political system, which I think is one of the biggest issues facing millennials here in Philadelphia, is having to navigate Philadelphia's sometimes antiquated local government. And the barriers to four young people in engaging in politics at the lowest rung, and even just as constituents, can sometimes be incredibly frustrating as a citizen in the city, as a young person or an older person, but definitely as a young person.
And it must feel pretty analog to you. I mean, if you need to have something fixed, you have to go down to an office somewhere and find someone to talk to.
Sort of. It's, I always tell this story. Earlier this year, during one of the snowstorms, the trash on our street was not picked up for 16 days. Which is an incredibly
long time
to have trash piling up on a row home lined block. And everyone I was telling about it was just like, oh, you need to call your council person. You got to call your council person about that. And I just kept thinking, I have to call my council person
to get my trash
picked up? That seems totally backwards, completely. What a waste of time for my council person, too, who's, you know, they have a lot of power in this city. And they're also fielding trash complaints. And that's what I did. I also went through the other like systems of that are in place for dealing with quality of life issues, Philly 311, all of that. But I think it was the council person that did the trick.
And I want to pick up on that. But going to you, Juliana, because you're part of technically Philly, in many ways, social media is a or can be a kind of workaround to make a system work. I don't know whether you have found that or not.
Yeah, I guess it's funny when Emily talked about contacting 311. The only way I ever contact 311 now is via Twitter.
Oh, is that right?
But it works most of the time. So like open fire hydrants and things like that. But yeah, it's interesting. I use social media a lot for my reporting. Like it's so Twitter and LinkedIn. I was just explaining to my friend last night how LinkedIn has become such a great reporting tool. So I do like business reporting, and I didn't have LinkedIn until like 6 months ago, and I was like sort of kicking myself because I realized that that was like a great way to find stories.
Well, and David, about a minute or so before we have to say take a very short break. I mean, how do you see then the role of social media?
Well, I think it's incredibly empowering for this generation. It not only allows us to do all the things that were just described, but it also has been the tool that's led young people to power revolutions halfway across the world and to, you know, have their voices heard. We've never had more people who are writers and creators. We've never had such a way for people, anybody, to express an idea and an opinion and share it with the world. So I think it makes people in this generation actually feel very empowered that they can actually have a voice in any kind of way that they would like.
Do you see it that way, Emily?
I do, but I also...
In spite of the frustrations?
Yes, I do. I am an avid user of pretty much every social network, and especially Twitter is my favorite, where I've met a lot of great people in the city who are doing grassroots activism. We've been able to connect and exchange ideas about different community-driven projects across the city, and I would have never met many of these people otherwise. But at the same time, I feel like, especially in a city like Philadelphia that has such a significant digital divide, this action that and conversation that is taking place online has to happen on the street and on the ground. That's something that my sister Anya is always saying. You know, the reason that census polls are able to get all their stats is because they go door to door. You have to pound the pavement, and I think that's especially important in this city.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. We are doing a show that we're calling How Millennials See the World, and that's Emily Doley, who joins us along with Juliana Reyes and also David Burstein, and we want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents Herringbone now through July 27th, starring 10-time Barrymore nominee Ben Dibble. George Herringbone is a unique kind of vaudeville star with the looks, the voice, and the moves. He also has a little help, which is more than he bargained for. Herringbone is a harrowing musical ghost story that explores the true price of fame. Tickets at flashpointtheater.org and 267-997-3312. Flashpoint Theater proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Miscarriages happen all the time, but for many people, they're still considered a taboo topic.
People don't talk about it when they have miscarriages, and you feel alone. You're going through this grieving, and you feel like you're the only one that's going through it.
We'll continue our look at miscarriages next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Rutgers Professional MBA supports WHYY and offers busy professionals the opportunity to earn a 21-month accelerated MBA degree without disrupting their full-time career. Classes held Saturdays with two new cohorts starting this August in Princeton and Mount Laurel. Information sessions Wednesday, July 16th, 6:30 p.m. Burlington County College, or Thursday, July 17th, 6:30 p.m. at Mercer County Community College. pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700. The Rutgers School of Business at Camden. Expect more. Be more.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Emily Doley. She's a producer of the TEDx Philadelphia Conference, co-organizer of the West Rockland Street Project in Germantown with her sister. Also with us, Juliana Reyes, and she's lead reporter at Technically Philly. And joining us from New York City and from the NPR Bureau in New York is David Burstein, CEO of Run for America, and he's also the author of a book called Fast Future, How Millennials Are Shaping Our World, our topic in this hour of Radio Times, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. David, Emily talked about the digital divide that she observes here in Philadelphia and even particularly on the street where she lives. You write about that in Fast Future.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's obviously a big concern as we think about this generation and the fact that technology has become so ubiquitous. I mean, I do want to point out that, you know, now most studies indicate that 99% of people in this generation have some kind of regular at daily access to the internet. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's using it for the purposes we might hope, but the fact that people in this generation now have something in common more than the fact that they, you know, breathe and they sleep, and that you add to that pantheon thinking about the connectivity, I think is really important. So it provides a platform for a lot of things, but, you know, as Emily was mentioning, it's not a panacea for all problems, and it's not a substitute for what happens in the real world. And I think millennials understand that. There's a big misperception that millennials think the entire world is online. I don't think anybody in this generation really lives that way. If anything, technology enhances a lot of connections and ways you live and things you do in the real world. It enhances those experiences. It enhances ways to connect with your friends. It enhances opportunities for people to connect. So I think that we really have to think about how we make sure that that access is equal and how we also make sure we're educating people to take the most advantage of the internet possible, how to be responsible citizens when it comes to thinking about issues like privacy in the post-NSA world, how we think about these questions, I think is really, really important.
And it's also something, Emily, on your street, as you said, you live in what sounds like a street with some low-income families living there. And for them, if they want to know about some of the meetings of your group, you have to knock on their door and tell them.
Yeah, sure. My sister is the block captain on our street, and the primary way that we can communicate with residents is through flyering and going door-to-door and holding block meetings out publicly on the street, like rounding up chairs, and there's a meeting so people see and they walk on down. We also have a pretty popular blog that is all about our civic project that's visited primarily by people around the city, but not from our own street. And also around the country and the world, like we get emails from people from England who want to know about our projects and some of the sort of more tactical urbanism type things that we're testing out. But communicating day to day with the low income residents of our street is in person.
Juliana, is Philadelphia a good place for millennials to live? Do you think you've lived here a couple of years, about 3 years?
Yeah, I lived here for 3 years, and I do think it's a really good place for millennials to live. I mean, at least this millennial.
Talking about yourself, obviously.
Yeah, yes. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who used to live in New York, and he was sort of comparing the two cities, and he asked me, so, like, is that, like, we were having sort of a little fight over Philly and New York, and I told him, like, I would only live here if, like, this was where I wanted to live. And if I wanted to live elsewhere, I would go somewhere else. And he was like, that's the problem with you as, like, a young person. Like, you think the world is your oyster. but
not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
You think the world is your oyster.
Yeah.
Well, David, I don't know if it's true for many millennials or even a large percentage of millennials, but it seems that you are attracted to cities. Is that true?
It's absolutely true. I mean, there are a lot of things that make cities attractive to millennials, you know, as they're thinking about their lives. I mean, the first is, you know, that there's a community of people there. And this is very much a social generation, not just in terms of social media, but in terms of our desire to have close relationships, to have friendships, to be social, to go out, to do things, go see movies, go eat out at restaurants, to travel. I mean, all this stuff is really fundamental to the generation. Also, this is not a generation of people who are buying cars. It's not a generation of people who are buying homes. It's not a generation of people who are getting married. All these numbers are the lowest they've ever been for a generation at this age. So what cities provide is a constant amount of flexibility for people to move around. The average millennial will have 12 different jobs by the time they turn 38. So the idea of going into a city where you're not necessarily tied to, you know, the people on your street, but you're tied to a more ability to be transient, I think is really, really important. But also public transportation, the ability to get around fast and quickly, the environmental issues. I mean, there's a lot about cities that really attract millennials. And I think it is one of the challenges, because what's happening all over this country is something that, you know, I think is we should be raising the alarm about, which is this rural brain drain, where you have communities, you know, not in places necessarily like New York, but in the Midwest and the Plains and the Southwest, where people are leaving small towns in droves to go to either nearby cities or faraway cities. And it's leaving a lot of towns all over America totally stripped of this kind of talent and a very quickly aging population. So it's something that we should really be concerned about and think how we think about this bigger demographic picture across the country. Because while a lot of cities are getting younger and younger, a lot of small towns are getting older and older, which presents a lot of big challenges.
I mean, it's interesting to think about flexibility and mobility. I'm looking at you, Emily, because you now are back in Philadelphia. You've lived here for a while in the house where you grew up, on the street where you grew up.
Yes, which is quite an experience. It's I was gone for about like 12 years and then moved back after college because I got a job in Mount Airy and I could walk right up the street and hop on the 23 and get there in 10 minutes. But I'm one of the millennials with a car. I take a mix of public transit and also drive to get around. Mm-hmm. But I would completely agree that cities are extremely attractive for our generation. And I think Philadelphia is a really great place to be a young person. There's so much to do. And most of it is actually pretty cheap. There's also a calm in the city that I mean, some people might argue with that, but I love New York. But every time I go for a weekend or a few days, I'm so happy to be back. I'm exhausted. and I like that Philadelphia is it's just the right size for me.
Do you have a car, Juliana?
No, I don't know how to drive. Well, I don't have my license, I guess I should say.
But so you don't need, do you feel like you need one or need a car or want a car or need a license?
Not at all. Actually, and if I want to go somewhere where I need a car, then I have a friend who could take me. But I bike pretty much everywhere. After about a year or two of being too afraid to do it, I just...
You're on your bike now?
Yeah.
How about for you, David?
I don't own a car, but I think the other thing here is that people also, if they need a car for some reason, they don't have a friend who has it, there's an increasingly large number of car share programs. Philly has a car share program. You know, companies like Uber, like Zipcar, I mean, all these kind of things that you know, a plethora of options to say, well, if I ever need a car, there is an option out there for me. So I think we're seeing this increased level of optionality on just about everything that, you know, avoids us having to make a big commitment. And particularly when you think about cars and homes, I mean, these are huge purchases. I mean, you're talking about a generation that doesn't have a lot of money. One of the only reasons this generation is doing, you know, as well as it is from a financial perspective is because we're not making these huge cost investments that young people typically make at this stage in their life. So the only way that we can sort of make up for the fact that we're not making as much money as previous generations is not by doing these things. But also it's important to remember that this is not just an economic choice. A lot of it is a lifestyle choice. A lot of it is the fact that people are moving to cities and people are saying, you know, thinking about environmental impact, people are thinking about all these things as part of their decision about what they actually want to own.
And that's David Burstein, CEO of Run for America, also author of a new book called Fast Future, How Millennials Are Shaping Our World. And again, also with us here in our Philadelphia studio, Juliana Reyes, and she's a lead reporter at Technically Philly, and Emily Doley, she is the organizer of the TEDx conference here in Philadelphia, producer of Ideas, and co-organizer of the West Rockland Street Project in Germantown with her sister. And we are talking about how millennials view the world. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Interestingly, and we're talking about money now, is that none of you talked about the recession. None of you talked about student debt. I don't know, since I know you went to college at George Washington University. Do you have student debt, Emily?
Oh, of course.
Of course, because you're a millennial?
I'll tell everyone how much it is, too. I was lucky enough to get some scholarships, but I owe about $50,000, which is a lot less than many of my friends, for going to a school that in 4 years would have cost me about $160,000.
Wow. And this is from at GW?
Yeah.
To GW.
And I graduated in 2005.
So you're paying off, I mean...
Right. Well, I mean, I have like, I'm locked in with low interest rate loans. And honestly, I don't, some people obsess about like their loans and that sort of debt. And it really depends on if you had private loans versus... working with Sallie Mae or any other sort of government-assisted loans. And so I just don't really think too much about it, but yeah.
But it's a reality. How about for you, Juliana?
No, I don't have any college loans personally to pay off. I've been really privileged that my parents took out loans and are paying them. I think it might also partly be a sort of a cultural thing. So my parents grew up in the Philippines, and there's this very strong sense of the parents will provide, and so it's like you go to school and you get a job after, and then you stay financially independent.
Wow.
But yeah, I've been really lucky.
But you must know people, have friends who have big college loans.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. How about for you, David? How much of an issue do you think this is for millennials?
Well, it's a huge issue for millennials. I mean, I was fortunate that my parents saved, you know, money for a long time for me to be able to go to college, and I did. So I don't have any loans. But I went to NYU, which is, you know, one of the colleges that has one of the highest debt loads for student debt loads for graduating students, mm-hmm. and it's incredibly expensive. And I think that, you know, this is for some people, you know, as Emily was just talking about, for some people it really weighs on them. For some people, it's sort of a fact of life. And I think that we have to think about how this fits into the bigger picture of this generation looking forward. The recession had an enormous impact on people in this generation, but it also changed a lot of the habits of this generation. So you're not seeing, for instance, on top of the debt that is coming on the student loans, you're not seeing huge levels of credit card debt, much lower than it used to be. You're seeing much lower levels of, you know, auto debt and home ownership, things like that. And it's important to put that into the picture, because one of the big challenges is, you know, when the average American has, you know, a considerable amount of debt, and when you look at how millennials are actually averaging, they're actually decreasing their debt load overall, because they're not taking on more debt and they're paying off the debt they have. So I think that's important to remember when people talk about this generation as being, you know, so overwhelmed by debt that they're never going to be able to do anything, they're never going to be able to think, they're never going to be able to move forward. You know, I think there is a mix, but I don't think that's the overwhelming thing that's weighing this generation down. In fact, as the economic crisis has gotten worse, young people consistently said they were more optimistic about their own economic future in the face of those challenges.
Well, what I also hear, David, are people saying, you know, millennials, you need to start buying houses, you need to start buying cars, you need to start making some of these big purchases to keep our big economy afloat. Does that resonate with you at all, David?
Well, I mean, yeah, sure, people will say that, but I actually think it's in some ways a inspired choice on the part of this generation to say that, you know, we don't need the things that other people have had. This goes back to what we're talking about at the beginning of this conversation, really, which is that this is a different generation. This is a generation who's not, you know, going through the traditional life plan, which was, you know, go to college if you can, get married very shortly thereafter, you know, buy a home, get a job that you're going to have. have for the rest of your life, and then have kids, you know, get a dog. I mean, this is not the way that millennials are looking at it. When, you know, home ownership, the dream of American home ownership, was sold to people throughout the 40s and the 50s in particular, it was about this idea of planting yourself in a community, right? If you have a home, you can have a community. Well, today, young people have all sorts of ways to create communities, which some of which are based in geography, but increasingly they're based not in geography. They're based in around ideas. They're based around common interests. They're global communities. They're communities of friends that transcend geography. It used to be when you left a town, you never heard from those friends again that you may have had there. Now it's constantly connected. So I think we're really questioning, do we really need these things in terms of what they can provide? I think it's incumbent upon the people who are in these industries to actually start thinking about how can they readjust how they frame the value. Realtors have usually had to answer the question, why should you buy this home, not why should you buy a home? And I think that's the question we need to be causing these industries to actually do a better job of pushing.
Emily, how do you think about your future? Or do you spend a lot of time thinking about your future?
Well, what is future? Like,
I don't
am
know.
I supposed to buy, like, buy a house, get married, and have children?
No, I'm not even saying that is in your
is
future
that my
or not.
Future? I'll speak on those things because I don't own a house. I haven't really thought much about buying a house. I think I would probably rent for a considerable amount of time. Probably, I would have kids late. I would like to have a kid, but late. My mom was an older parent. It was fine. So I wouldn't see having a kid until my late 30s mm-hmm. or maybe early 40s mm-hmm. even. And in terms of jobs and careers, I very much would like to stay in Philadelphia. When I first moved back to the city from D.C., I figured I'd probably be here for a couple years and then I was going to move to New York. And it was when I started doing the civic work in Germantown in my neighborhood and seeing actual change happen as a result that I realized I wanted to stay here. And that was a really powerful moment where I just sort of stopped thinking about going to live in Brooklyn with my friends.
And staying in Germantown.
And staying, well, maybe not necessarily staying in one neighborhood. I'd like to try on another neighborhood. But staying in Philadelphia for sure, because that's one of the special things about the size of this city. If you are active and engaged and you've got a big idea and the wherewithal to give it a go, you can see real results happen here. And it's not that hard, I think. And that's a big plus.
Do you think about your future, Deliana? Or are you even mapping out your future in any way? You can say no.
If I do think about the future, it's usually the near future. So it's 6 months or a year. But it's true. I don't think long term that much. I think I know as much as I want to stay here for the foreseeable future. I really love being rooted here in Philly, having the deli at the corner and they know me and having my favorite stores and restaurants and bars and things like that. So sort of like Emily said, I see a lot of opportunity here mm-hmm. for me now, not thinking too much about leaving it or trying other new things.
But do you feel optimistic about the future? Or do you even think in those terms?
I do feel optimistic about the future. I think with all the news about the school district, I think that is the one sort of terrifying thing. And I think that a lot of us, I don't know, young people, maybe we don't think about it too much yet because it's not so relatable that we have kids, but I think that's coming,
Where you have to make some kind of a choice.
Yeah.
Let's take a short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with three millennials about how they view their future and how they view the world. Juliana Reyes, David Burstein, and Emily Doley. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Brick Simple LLC supports WHYY. Serving Fortune 500s to startups, Brick Simple provides technology consulting and app development for the web, iPhone, iPad, Android, and Google Glass. More at BrickSimple.com.
The new book, Trans Bodies, Trans Selves, is a resource manual for the transgender community inspired by the feminist health manual, Our Bodies, Ourselves. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the editor, and two of the contributors talk about their experiences transitioning to the gender they identified with. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
An old-timer on some burning issues for the American West.
I liken it to a 500-pound gorilla. Once that fire takes over to a certain extent, it can go anywhere it wants.
Long traditions with new urgency. Firefighting in the American wilderness. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
WHYY's 2014 Youth Media Awards honors the creativity of local students grades 6 through 12. Young producers can submit their videos now in a variety of categories. Learn more at whyy.org/awards.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Let me quickly reintroduce our guest, Emily Doley, producer of the Ideas Conference TEDx Philadelphia, co-organizer with her sister of the West Rockland Street Project in the Germantown section of Philadelphia. Juliana Reyes is a lead reporter at Technically Philly, and joining us from the studios, NPR studios in New York, David Burstein, CEO of Run for America, author of Fast Future, How Millennials Are Shaping Our World, our topic in this hour of Radio Times. And let me get Rich to join us. Rich calling us from Gulf Mills. You're on Radio Times. Rich, go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So the one thing that's lacking in the three individuals is their decision and desire to take risk for themselves. While they're willing to work in the community and risk their professions on staying in Philly and doing well by the city and themselves, they're not choosing to take any risk for their economic future, and that's really what they need to start to do so that they will be able to afford or at least accumulate some assets in the future that will be able to support their growing desires or demands.
Well, Rich, let me pick up on that. Let me just ask you, though, but if you don't know where you're going to live or where that job is that you might have for 5 or 10 years, does it make sense to buy a house?
It absolutely does. The house is your number one asset, whether it's a one-bedroom apartment or a two-bedroom apartment, whether they begin to establish their own credit rating or if they have the property and it's in a good location and it's well financed because interest rates are at historic lows, they can then use that property to rent out if they choose to go to another city and use that asset as leverage to then either buy another property or sell it and make a profit.
Well, let me just jump in here and just pick up on what Rich is saying, I guess, because Emily, you're sitting across from me and I'm looking at you listening to Rich. What are your thoughts?
Well, buying a house is just financially not in the cards for me right now, but I do know other young people who have purchased properties and renovated them, or even purchased apartments and rent them when they end up moving in with someone else. So I don't think that it's really so give and take. I really think it depends. Personally, right now, I would rather have savings mm-hmm. than own property necessarily. But at the same time, something that I guess we haven't discussed in Philadelphia is the low cost of living. And a lot of millennials have very cheap rents and are living in areas of the city where they're really spending very little on their apartment. So it might be a harder sell to get Philadelphia millennials to start buying properties.
I hear you. Let me quote from an email that we got. This is from Pierre. I'm 34. I'm on the cusp of Gen X and the millennial generation. Although I identify slightly more with Gen X, I mostly feel without a generation. Something that has bothered me regarding this topic is when my 73-year-old mother criticizes millennials for not being angry and involved enough for the social and political problems of our time. She often remarks that her generation was more active in protesting and challenging politics positions in the law, and this generation seems either lazy, uninformed, apathetic, or all three. And he'd love to hear from our guests. David, you address some of that in your book, and it is a criticism, I guess. It's been lodged against millennials, which is, where are you when it comes to marching down the street in protest?
Well, I mean, this is one of the things that I think, you know, is one of the biggest myths about millennials. We, you know, this is a generation that is incredibly active and engaged and involved. I mean, you know, just a little bit of evidence. Look at the three people here. But I think, you know, the fact that we're not marching in the streets is not a reflection of our lack of anger, but a factor of two things. One, the fact that marching in the streets no longer is the most effective way to create change. You know, in the 1960s, there had never been hundreds of thousands of people who showed up in Washington to march. So when people showed up to march for civil rights, people paid attention because it was a kind of scale that people had never seen before. When people went out to protest the Vietnam War, you know, these things had real impact because people weren't going around marching every day for lots and lots of stuff. In the time period since, we've had protests and movements for all sorts of things, and politicians and our political system in particular has developed a really great way of avoiding, you know, large swells of people. We've never lived in a worse time for direct advocacy. You know, the idea that, oh, if we could only get a million people to sign this petition and deliver it to, you know, X legislator or X congressman or senator, we could get something done. The system is so broken that doesn't even work anymore. So I think one of the challenges in this generation is we've made a calculated look at the political system and said, look, I will vote, and young people turn out in very high numbers to vote in elections, but at the end of the day, this is probably not the best use of my time. If I want to make change in the world, I'm going to go start a business. I'm going to go start a nonprofit. I'm going to go work, do the work that all of us here are doing, find other ways to do that. I think that is a smart move at the moment for people in this generation because it's the best way to make impact. But in the long term, it's a big risk to our political system because what we're left with is the people who are participating mm-hmm. are the voices who shout the loudest. They're the most polarized. They're the most partisan. And they're the least competent in a lot of cases. So we need to bring a lot of the talent that's working outside the system into the system in order to make it better. The challenges we're dealing with, I think, are much more complex and nuanced than the 60s. The challenges of the 60s were very, very big, crucial issues about life and death and basic human rights in this country. And I think today the issues we're dealing with, an issue like the environment and climate change, is an incredibly serious issue, but there's not the same kind of definitiveness about what we do about it. What's the bill? What's the piece of legislation? What's the action everybody should take? It's changed a lot.
Yeah, let me give Juliana a chance to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Juliana.
I think it's also depends on who you know, because my friends are marching in the streets. And I think the movements are more grassroots, and like David said, they're not huge, but they are affecting change. So I have friends who are organizers at student organizations and immigrant rights organizations, and I've seen that the work they do, and I feel like they are angry, and they are socially engaged, and they're doing stuff, and they're doing it here.
Right. Well, I think of Occupy Wall Street as well. Mm-hmm. It was a couple of years ago, but and some have questioned, you know, did it actually have an impact? But I think some of that could be said of some of the protests also in the 60s.
Go ahead, Emily. Also the protests around public schools in Philadelphia is another example of really intergenerational engagement because we've got a much younger generation students who are actually attending some of the public schools in the city with their supporters and their parents and whatnot marching in the streets in the city. So I don't know. I have to agree and disagree. I do think that some of what appears to be a lack of political involvement is just that, as what David said, that how you get involved mm-hmm. has changed, and what you do has changed, and what you can do. The opportunities are much greater.
We have an email from Catherine. She says, this is about student debt. After finishing law school, I will be over $180,000 in debt, which includes undergraduate loans. I know that it will be worth it, but it will prevent me from buying a house and getting married anytime soon. I've been with my boyfriend for over 6 years, and many older people have asked why we aren't married. And it's frustrating when they criticize us for living together without being married first. I would rather not enter a marriage or buy a house without at least paying off a good chunk of my debt first. And, you know, I'm sure, Emily, you can relate to that.
Sort of. I mean, I think that's a really personal opinion to not get married while you're in debt. but you could. She could also just go to City Hall and have a very inexpensive wedding at the same time, and there would be some tax benefits to that as well. But how you combine your debts is another story and a personal one.
Indeed, it's a personal decision. Here's another email. This is from Joe. He says, the first thing that came to my mind was the O.J. trial. I was 10 years old when I first learned that rich, famous people don't go to jail, and instances like Enron or the housing bubble only reinforce that. As a millennial, I have no faith in our judicial system. I'm looking at you, Juliana, just curious about your response. Do you remember the O.J. trial? Were you watching that or watching people watching that?
I was watching people watch that. I was definitely a little bit too little to have thoughts about it.
How about for you, David?
I do remember it, and I think that, you know, the broad trend here is things like this, you know, constant institutional failure have really marked this generation's view. We've seen businesses fail. We've seen financial institutions fail. We've seen the housing market fail. We've seen our political institutions fail. We've seen education systems fail. So I don't think it's, you know, surprising that people are not jumping up to, you know, invest in the stock market in this generation, buy homes, be part of, you know, be part of these different things. They're asking these questions because we've seen so many examples of these things really failing. And I think it, the trust level has just never been lower for people in this generation. So all of these are just more examples of that being reinforced. I don't know if people really understand the depths of how much this has sort of come into this generation's consciousness, this kind of lack of trust of big institutions.
You're nodding your head, Emily.
Yeah, I think that that's especially true in Philadelphia when you're talking about local politics and local government and scandal and corruption that has gone on for a number of years. I mean, one of the things that comes to mind is just there was a CDC in my neighborhood that just lost millions and millions and millions of dollars and never invested it into the neighborhood over the years. And there were, you know, no one was indicted. Everything was swept under the rug. And now Germantown's digging out from that. And I'm experiencing that. And why would you have any faith if that was allowed and no one was even prosecuted?
Well, I sometimes wonder, I mean, I'm older than the three of you, and there certainly was corruption when I was coming up. I wonder, too, whether we just know more things now, but we're just more connected to the world, so you can't not know things. And Juliana, since you write for Technically Philly, I mean, you're plugged in, right?
Yeah, I try to be. I think that's a good point. I think there's a lot more media out there, and we have access to it.
It's everywhere, really.
Yeah.
Or the possibility. Let me read a couple more emails. And interestingly, we're getting many more emails and tweets than we are phone calls. I think that tells you something about our audience. And we're talking about millennials with millennials. This is a Terry saying, I'm a baby boomer, have had the opportunity in the past 5 years to meet many millennials while working on environmental issues. Their courage and their insights inspire me. We also have an email from Kat. I'm a millennial who graduated college without debt, got married, bought a house, had a kid a few years ago. I think the defining factor of my generation is that we are comfortable doing our own thing. We're just more comfortable going with the flow as we've been shown that everything else evolves. We like cities because we like to define our lives, not to be defined by them. David, does that meet your definition or does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think that's spot on, and it goes to the earlier email about sort of people saying, why aren't you getting married? I mean, people are, I think, much freer to choose their own path and to say, I'm not going to be, you know, encumbered by what people have previously done, how people have previously thought about the role of people in their 20s or when you get married. I mean, and for some people, that means they're delaying it. For other people, it means they're doing it. So I think that's really at the essence of this generation, is this desire to be more independent. We're free of a lot of sort of the social pressures, I think. Not necessarily free of realities, right, but we're free of a lot of the social pressures that people have been under for a long time.
Juliana, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I think we're sort of definitely defined by this choosing your own path, choosing your own destiny, especially when it comes to jobs. So instead of joining a company, we want to start our own. And, you know, in my work, I cover tech startups here in Philly, and they are almost all started by, you know, millennials, these young people, whether they're in their early 30s and they worked one job before, or they're 21 and they're a student at college and they haven't even graduated. You know, the three people that started the company that I work at, Technically Philly, they're all millennials. And so it's been really sort of inspiring to see all these young people in Philly just sort of doing their own thing and starting their own company, hiring people, making like that kind of economic development on their own.
Right. At the same time, though, I think that jobs are one of the issues that are facing job availability, really,
sure.
One of the issues facing millennials in the city. And it's not so much like your entry level or right out of college or even that second job. It's like the second and third stages of your career. It's difficult to move up the ladder, so to speak, in the city. And so I think that that's one been cited as one of the reasons why millennials leave Philadelphia after 5 or 10 years. Mm. I have a friend who is about 25 who's just decided to leave, partially for career purposes and family, but also just because she felt change came a little too slow to Philadelphia, which I understand.
We're almost out of time here. David, one of the things or the phrases that you use in your book to describe millennials as pragmatic idealists. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think it's a really good way to think about, you know, this generation and many of the things we've talked about before. You know, previously, pragmatism and idealism lay on opposite ends of the spectrum. We either were pragmatic or idealistic. And today, millennials deeply want to be part of meaningful change, change the world, do big things. But at the same time, we understand that you have to be pragmatic and practical in how you do that, that you need a plan. You need to sometimes work with existing institutions, sometimes work outside of them. And I think that that kind of thinking is really, really appropriate for the times that we're living in, which is a world where lots of big new things can happen, where we can disrupt industries, where we can move very quickly to make change, but also where we're marked by actually getting things done and trying to be very deeply thoughtful about how things happen, and there's a real reality to all of it. So I think it's actually one that's going to serve this generation well as we become institutional leaders in society over the next 20 years.
Emily, you have 20 seconds because I know you wanted to talk about intergenerational relationships. I know that isn't enough time, but very quickly.
I think boomers and millennials have a lot in common and can benefit from knowing each other, working together, and having friendships together. And I've seen that throughout my career. I started working at a communications firm out of college and worked primarily like with people who are in their 40s and 50s. And that was really valuable for me.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Emily Doley, thank you very much.
Thanks.
And Juliana Reyes, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And David Burstein, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.